Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Part 2, Chapter 18 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Daylight had been wholly truthful when he told Dede that he had had no real friends. On speaking terms with thousands, on fellowship and drinking terms with hundreds, he was a lonely man. He failed to find the one man, or group of several men, with whom he could be really intimate. Cities did not make for comradeship, as did the Alaskan Trail. Besides, the types of men were different. Scornful and contemptuous of businessmen on the one hand, on the other, his relations with the San Francisco bosses had been more an alliance of expediency than anything else. He had felt more of a kinship for the franker brutality of the bosses and their captains, but they had failed to claim any deep respect. They were too prone to crookedness. Bonds were better than men's word in this modern world, and one had to look carefully to the bonds. In the old Yukon days it had been different. Bonds didn't go. A man said he had so much, and even in a poker game his appeasement was accepted. Larry Hagen, who rose ably to the largest demands of Daylight's operations, and who had few illusions and less hypocrisy, might have proven a chum had it not been for his temperamental twist. Strange genius that he was, a Napoleon of the law, with a power of visioning that far exceeded Daylight's, he had nothing in common with Daylight outside the office. He spent his time with books, a thing Daylight could not abide. Also, he devoted himself to the endless writing of plays, which never got beyond manuscript form, and though Daylight only sensed the secret taint of it, was a confirmed but temperate eater of hashish. Hagen lived all his life cloistered with books in a world of agitation. With the outdoor world, he had no understanding, no tolerance. In food and drink, he was abstemious as a monk, while exercise was a thing abhorrent. Daylight's friendships, in lieu of anything closer, were drinking friendships and roistering friendships. And with the passing of the Sunday rides with Dede, he fell back more and more upon these for diversion. The cocktail wall of inhibition he reared more assiduously than ever. The big red motor car was out more frequently now, while a stable hand was hired to give Bob exercise. In his early San Francisco days, there had been intervals of easement between his deals. But in this present biggest deal of all, the strain was unremitting. Not in a month or two or three could his huge land investment be carried to a successful consummation. And so complete and wide-reaching was it that complications and knotty situations constantly arose. Every day brought its problems, and when he had solved them in his masterful way, he left the office in his big car, almost sighing with relief at anticipation of the approaching double martini. Rarely was he made tipsy. His constitution was too strong for that. Instead, he was that direst of all drinkers, the steady drinker, deliberate and controlled, who averaged a far higher quantity of alcohol than the irregular and violent drinker. For 6 weeks, hard running, he had seen nothing of Dede except in the office, and there he resolutely refrained from making approaches. But by the seventh Sunday his hunger for her overmastered him. It was a stormy day. A heavy southeast gale was blowing, and squall after squall of rain and wind swept over the city. He could not take his mind off her, and a persistent picture came to him of her sitting by a window and sewing feminine fripperies of some sort. When the time came for his first pre-luncheon cocktail to be served to him in his rooms, he did not take it. Filled with a daring determination, he glanced at his notebook for Dede's telephone number and called for the switch. At first it was her landlady's daughter who was raised, but in a minute he heard the voice he had been hungry to hear. "I just wanted to tell you that I'm coming out to see you," he said. "I didn't want to break in on you without warning, that was all." "Has something happened?" came her voice. "I'll tell you when I get there," he evaded. He left the red car 2 blocks away and arrived on foot at the pretty, three-storied, shingled Berkeley house. For an instant only he was aware of an inward hesitancy, but the next moment he rang the bell. He knew that what he was doing was in direct violation of her wishes, and that he was setting her a difficult task to receive as a Sunday caller the multimillionaire and notorious Elim Harnish of newspaper fame. On the other hand, the one thing he did not expect of her was what he would have termed silly female capers. And in this he was not disappointed. She came herself to the door to receive him and shake hands with him. He hung his mackintosh and hat on the rack in the comfortable square hall and turned to her for direction. "They are busy in there," she said, indicating the parlor, from which came the boisterous voices of young people, and through the open door of which he could see several college youths. "So you will have to come in to my rooms." She led the way through the door opening out of the hall to the right, and once inside, he stood awkwardly rooted to the floor, gazing about him and at her, and all the time trying not to gaze. In his perturbation, he failed to hear and see her invitation to a seat. So these were her quarters. The intimacy of it, and her making no fuss about it, was startling, but it was no more than he would have expected of her. It was almost 2 rooms in one. The one room he was in, evidently the sitting room, and the other he could see into, the bedroom. Beyond an oaken dressing table, with an orderly litter of combs and brushes and dainty feminine knick-knacks, there was no sign of it being used as a bedroom. The broad couch, with a cover of old rose and banked high with cushions, he decided, must be the bed. But it was farthest from any experience of a civilized bed he had ever had. Not that he saw much of detail in that awkward moment of standing. His general impression was one of warmth and comfort and beauty. There were no carpets, and on the hardwood floor he caught a glimpse of several wolf and coyote skins. What captured and perceptibly held his eye for a moment was a crouched Venus that stood on a Steinway upright against a background of mountain lion skin on the wall. But it was Dede herself that smote most sharply upon sense and perception. He had always cherished the idea that she was very much a woman. The lines of her figure, her hair, her eyes, her voice, and bird-like laughing ways had all contributed to this, but here, in her own rooms, clad in some flowing, clinging gown, the emphasis of sex was startling. He had been accustomed to her only in trim tailor suits and shirt-waists, or in riding costume of velvet corduroy, and he was not prepared for this new revelation. She seemed so much softer, so much more pliant and tender and lissome. She was a part of this atmosphere of quietude and beauty. She fitted into it just as she had fitted in with the sober office furnishings. "Won't you sit down?" she repeated. He felt like an animal long denied food. His hunger for her welled up in him, and he proceeded to wolf the dainty morsel before him. Here was no patience, no diplomacy. The straightest direct way was none too quick for him, and, had he known it, the least unsuccessful way he could have chosen. "Look here," he said, in a voice that shook with passion, "there's one thing I won't do, and that's propose to you in the office. That's why I'm here. Dede Mason, I want you. I just want you." While he spoke, he advanced upon her, his black eyes burning with bright fire, his aroused blood swarthy in his cheek. So precipitate was he that she had barely time to cry out her involuntary alarm and to step back, at the same time catching one of his hands as he attempted to gather her into his arms. In contrast to him, the blood had suddenly left her cheeks. The hand that had warded his off and that still held it was trembling. She relaxed her fingers, and his arm dropped to his side. She wanted to say something, do something, to pass on from the awkwardness of the situation, but no intelligent thought nor action came into her mind. She was aware only of a desire to laugh. This impulse was partly hysterical and partly spontaneous humor, the latter growing from instant to instant. Amazing as the affair was, the ridiculous side of it was not veiled to her. She felt like one who had suffered the terror of the onslaught of a murderous footpad, only to find out that it was an innocent pedestrian asking the time. Daylight was the quicker to achieve action. "Oh, I know. I'm a sure enough fool," he said. I guess I'll sit down. Don't be scared, Miss Mason. I'm not real dangerous." "I'm not afraid," she answered with a smile, slipping down herself into a chair besides which, on the floor, stood a sewing basket from which, Daylight noted, some white fluffy thing of lace and muslin overflowed. Again she smiled, "though I confess you did startle me for the moment." "It's funny," Daylight sighed, almost with regret. "Here I am, strong enough to bend you around and tie knots in you. Here I am, used to having my will with man and beast and anything. And here I am sitting in this chair, as weak and helpless as a little lamb. You sure take the starch out of me." Dede vainly cudgeled her brains in quest for a reply to these remarks. Instead, her thought dwelt insistently upon the significance of his stepping aside in the middle of a violent proposal in order to make irrelevant remarks. What struck her was the man's certitude. So little did he doubt that he would have her, that he could afford to pause and generalize upon love and the effects of love. She noted his hand unconsciously slipping in the familiar way into the side coat pocket, where she knew he carried his tobacco and brown papers. "You may smoke if you want to," she said. He withdrew his hand with a jerk, as if something in the pocket had stung him. "No, I wasn't thinking of smoking. I was thinking of you. What's a man to do when he wants a woman but ask her to marry him? That's all that I'm doing. I can't do it in style, I know that, but I can use straight English, and that's good enough for me. I want you mighty bad, Miss Mason. You're in my mind most all the time now, and what I want to know is, well, do you want me? That's all." "I wish you hadn't asked," she said softly. "Maybe it's best you should know a few things before you give me an answer," he went on, ignoring the fact that the answer had already been given. "I never went after a woman before in my life, all reports to the contrary notwithstanding. The stuff you read about me in the papers and books about me being a lady killer is all wrong. There's not an iota of truth in it. I guess I've done more than my share of card playing and whiskey drinking, but women I've let alone. There was a woman that killed herself, but I didn't know she wanted me that bad, or else I'd have married her. Not for love, but to keep her from killing herself. She was the best of the boiling, but I never gave her any encouragement. I'm telling you all this because you've read about it, and I want you to get it straight from me. Lady killer, he snorted. Why, Miss Mason, I don't mind telling you that I've sure been scared of women all my life. You're the first one I've not been afraid of. That's the strange thing about it. I just plumb worship you, and yet I'm not afraid of you. Maybe it's because you're different from the women I know. You never chased me, lady killer. Why, I've been running away from ladies ever since I can remember. And I guess all that saved me was that I was strong in the wind and that I never fell down and broke a leg or anything. I didn't ever want to get married until after I met you, and until a long time after I met you. I cottoned to you from the start, but I never thought it would get as bad as marriage. Why, I can't get to sleep nights thinking of you and wanting you. He came to a stop and waited. She had taken the lace and muslin from the basket, possibly to settle her nerves and wits, and was sewing upon it. As she was not looking at him, he devoured her with his eyes. He noted the firm, efficient hands that could control a horse like Bob, that could run a typewriter almost as fast as a man could talk, that could sew on dainty garments, and that, doubtlessly, could play on the piano over there in the corner. Another ultra-feminine detail he noticed, her slippers. They were small and bronze. He had never imagined she had such a small foot. Street shoes and riding boots were all that he had ever seen on her feet, and they had given no advertisement of this. The bronze slippers fascinated him, and to them his eyes repeatedly turned. A knock came at the door, which she answered. Daylight could not help hearing the conversation. She was wanted at the telephone. "Tell him to call up again in 10 minutes," he heard her say, and the masculine pronoun caused in him a flashing twinge of jealousy. Well, he decided, whoever it was, Burning Daylight would give him a run for his money. The marvel to him was that a girl like Dee Dee hadn't been married long since. She came back smiling to him and resumed her sewing. His eyes wandered from the efficient hands to the bronze slippers and back again, and he swore to himself that there were mighty few stenographers like her in existence. That was because she must have come of pretty good stock and had a pretty good raisin. Nothing else could explain these rooms of hers and the clothes she wore and the way she wore them. "Those 10 minutes are flying," he suggested. "I can't marry you," she said. "You don't love me?" She shook her head. "Do you like me the littlest bit?" This time she nodded, at the same time allowing the smile of amusement to play on her lips. But it was amusement without contempt. The humorous side of a situation rarely appealed in vain to her. "Well, that's something to go on," he announced. "You've got to make a start to get started. I just liked you at first, and look what it's grown into. You recollect, you said you didn't like my way of life. Well, I've changed it a heap. I ain't gambling like I used to. I've gone into what you called the legitimate, making 2 minutes grow where one grew before. 300,000 folks where only 100,000 grew before. And this time next year, there'll be 2 million eucalyptus growing on the hills. Say, do you like me more than the littlest bit?" She raised her eyes from her work and looked at him as she answered. "I like you a great deal, but..." He waited a moment for her to complete the sentence, failing which, he went on himself. "I haven't an exaggerated opinion of myself, so I know I ain't bragging when I say I'll make a pretty good husband. You'd find I was no hand at nagging and fault-finding. I can guess what it must be for a woman like you to be independent. Well, you'd be independent as my wife. No strings on you. You could follow your own sweet will, and nothing would be too good for you. I'd give you everything your heart desired. Except yourself, she interrupted suddenly, almost sharply. Daylight's astonishment was momentary. I don't know about that. I'd be straight and square and live true. I don't hanker after divided affections. I don't mean that, she said. Instead of giving yourself to your wife, you would give yourself to the 300,000 people of Oakland, to your street railways and ferry routes, to the 2 million trees on the hills, to everything business and to all that that means. I'd see that I didn't, he declared stoutly. I'd be yours to command. You think so, but it would turn out differently. She suddenly became nervous. We must stop this talk. It's too much like attempting to drive a bargain. How much will you give? I'll give so much. I want more. And all that. I like you, but not enough to marry you, and I'll never like you enough to marry you. How do you know that? He demanded. Because I like you less and less. Daylight sat dumbfounded. The hurt showed itself plainly in his face. Oh, you don't understand, she cried wildly, beginning to lose self-control. It's not that way, I mean. I do like you. The more I've known you, the more I've liked you. And at the same time, the more I've known you, the less would I care to marry you. This enigmatic utterance completed Daylight's perplexity. Don't you see, she hurried on, I could have far easier married the Elam Harnish, fresh from the Klondike, when I first laid eyes on him long ago, than marry you sitting before me now. He shook his head slowly. That's one too many for me. The more you know and like a man, the less you want to marry him. Familiarity breeds contempt. I guess that's what you mean. No, no, she cried. But before she could continue, a knock came on the door. The 10 minutes is up, Daylight said. His eyes, quick with observation, like an Indian's, darted about the room while she was out. The impression of warmth and comfort and beauty predominated, though he was unable to analyze it, while the simplicity delighted him. Expensive simplicity, he decided, and most of it leftovers from the time her father went broke and died. He had never before appreciated a plain hardwood floor with a couple of wolfskins. It sure beat all the carpets in creation. He stared solemnly at a bookcase containing a couple of hundred books. There was mystery. He could not understand what people found so much to write about. Writing things and reading things were not the same as doing things. And he himself, primarily a man of action, doing things was alone comprehensible. His gaze passed on from the crouched Venus to a little tea table with all its fragile and exquisite accessories, and to a shining copper kettle and copper chafing dish. Chafing dishes were not unknown to him, and he wondered if she concocted suppers on this one for some of those university young men he had heard whispered about. One or two watercolors on the wall made him conjecture that she had painted them herself. There were photographs of horses and old masters, and the trailing purple of a burial of Christ held him for a time. But ever his gaze returned to that crouched Venus on the piano. To his homely, frontier-trained mind, it seemed curious that a nice young woman should have such a bold, if not sinful, object on display in her own room. But he reconciled himself to it by an act of faith. Since it was Dede, it must be eminently all right. Evidently, such things went along with culture. Larry Hagan had similar casts and photographs in his book-cluttered quarters. But then Larry Hagan was different. there was that hint of unhealth about him that Daylight invariably sensed in his presence, while Dede, on the contrary, seemed always so robustly wholesome, radiating an atmosphere compounded of the sun and wind and dust of the open road. And yet, if such a clean, healthy woman as she went in for naked women crouching on her piano, it must be all right. Dede made it all right. She could come pretty close to making anything all right. Besides, he didn't understand culture anyway. She re-entered the room, and as she crossed it to her chair, he admired the way she walked, while the bronze slippers were maddening. "I'd like to ask you several questions," he began immediately. "Are you thinking of marrying somebody?" She laughed merrily and shook her head. "Do you like anybody else more than you like me? That man at the phone just now, for instance." "There isn't anybody else. I don't know anybody I like well enough to marry. For that matter, I don't think I'm a marrying woman. Office work seems to spoil one for that." Daylight ran his eyes over her, from her face to the tip of a bronze slipper, in a way that made the color mantle in her cheeks. At the same time, he shook his head skeptically. "It strikes me that you are the most marrionist woman that ever made a man sit up and take notice. And now another question, you see. I've just got to locate the lay of the land. Is there anybody you like as much as you like me?" But Dede had herself well in hand. "That's unfair," she said, "and if you'd stop and consider, you will find that you are doing the very thing you disclaimed, namely, nagging. I refuse to answer any more of your questions. Let us talk about other things. How is Bob?" Half an hour later, whirling along through the rain on Telegraph Avenue toward Oakland, Daylight smoked one of his brown paper cigarettes and reviewed what had taken place. "It was not at all bad," was his summing up, though there had been much about it that was baffling. There was that liking him the more she knew him, and at the same time, wanting to marry him less. That was a puzzler. But the fact that she had refused him carried with it a certain elation. In refusing him, she had refused his $30 million. That was going some for a $90 a month stenographer who had known better ties. She wasn't after money, that was patent. Every woman he had encountered had seemed willing to swallow him down for the sake of his money. Why, he had doubled his fortune, made $15 million, since the day she first came to work for him, and behold, any willingness to marry him she might have possessed had diminished as his money had increased. "Gosh," he muttered, "if I clean up $100 million on this land deal, she won't even be on speaking terms with me." But he could not smile the thing away. It remained to baffle him, that enigmatic statement of hers, that she could more easily have married the Elam Harnish fresh from the Klondike than the present Elam Harnish. Well, he concluded, the thing to do was for him to become more like that old-time Daylight, who had come down out of the North to try his luck at the bigger game. But that was impossible. He could not set back the flight of time. Wishing wouldn't do it, and there was no other way. He might as well wish himself a boy again. Another satisfaction he'd cuddled to himself from their interview. He had heard of stenographers before who refused their employers and who invariably quit their positions immediately afterward. But Dede had not even hinted at such a thing. No matter how baffling she was, there was no nonsensical silliness about her. She was level-headed, but also he had been level-headed and was partly responsible for this. He hadn't taken advantage of her in the office. True, he had twice overstepped the bounds, but he had not followed it up and made a practice of it. She knew she could trust him. But in spite of all this, he was confident that most young women would have been silly enough to resign a position with a man they had turned down. And besides, after he had put it to her in the right light, she had not been silly over his sending her brother to Germany. "Gee," he concluded, as the car drew up before his hotel, "if I'd only known it as I do now, I'd have popped the question the first day she came to work. According to her say-so, that would have been the proper moment. She likes me more and more, and the more she likes me, the less she cares to marry me. Now what do you think of that? She sure must be fooling." End of part 2, chapter 18. Part 2, Chapter 19 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Once again, on a rainy Sunday, weeks afterward, Daylight proposed to Dede. As on the first time, he restrained himself until his hunger for her overwhelmed him and swept him away in his red automobile to Berkeley. He left the machine several blocks away and proceeded to the house on foot. But Dede was out. The landlady's daughter told him, and added, on second thought, that she was out walking in the hills. Furthermore, the young lady directed him where Dede's walk was most likely to extend. Daylight obeyed the girl's instructions, and soon the street he followed passed the last house, and itself ceased where began the first steep slopes of the open hills. The air was damp with the oncoming of rain, for the storm had not yet burst, though the rising wind proclaimed its imminence. As far as he could see, there was no sign of Dede on the smooth, grassy hills. To the right, dipping down into a hollow and rising again, was a large, fully grown eucalyptus grove. Here all was noise and movement, the lofty, slender-trunked trees swaying back and forth in the wind and clashing their branches together. In the squalls, above all the minor noises of creaking and groaning, arose a deep thrumming note, as of a mighty harp. Knowing Dede as he did, Daylight was confident that he would find her somewhere in this grove, where the storm effects were so pronounced. And find her he did, across the hollow and on the exposed crest of the opposing slope where the gale smote its fiercest blows. There was something monotonous, though not tiresome, about the way Daylight proposed. Guiltless of diplomacy, subterfuge, he was as direct and gusty as the gale itself. He had time neither for greeting nor apology. "It's the same old thing," he said. "I want you, and I've come for you. You've just got to have me, Dede, for the more I think about it, the more certain I am that you've got a sneaking liking for me that's something more than just ordinary liking, and you don't dast say that it isn't. Now, dast you?" He had shaken hands with her at the moment he began speaking, and he had continued to hold her hand. Now, when she did not answer, she felt a light but firmly insistent pressure, as of his drawing her to him. Involuntarily, she half yielded to him, her desire for the moment stronger than her will. Then suddenly she drew herself away, though permitting her hand still to remain in his. "You sure ain't afraid of me?" he asked, with quick compunction. "No," she smiled woefully. "Not of you, but of myself." "You haven't taken my dare," he urged, under this encouragement. "Please, please," she begged. "We can never marry, so don't let us discuss it." "Then I copper your bet to lose." He was almost gay now, for success was coming faster than his fondest imagining. She liked him, without a doubt, and without a doubt she liked him well enough to let him hold her hand. Well enough to be not repelled by the nearness of him. She shook her head. "No, it's impossible. You would lose your bet." For the first time, a dark suspicion crossed Daylight's mind, a clue that explained everything. "Say, you ain't been let in for some one of these secret marriages, have you?" The consternation in his voice and on his face was too much for her, and her laugh rang out, merry and spontaneous, as a burst of joy from the throat of a bird. Daylight knew his answer, and, vexed with himself, decided that action was more efficient than speech. So he stepped between her and the wind, and drew her so that she stood close in the shelter of him. An unusually stiff squall blew about them and thrummed overhead in the treetops, and both paused to listen. A shower of flying leaves enveloped them, and hard on the heel of the wind came driving drops of rain. He looked down on her and on her hair, wind-blown about her face. And because of her closeness to him and of a fresher and more poignant realization of what she meant to him, he trembled so that she was aware of it in the hand that held hers. She suddenly leaned against him, bowing her head until it rested lightly upon his breast. And so they stood while another squall, with flying leaves and scattered drops of rain, rattled past. With equal suddenness, she lifted her head and looked at him. "Do you know," she said, "I prayed last night about you. I prayed that you would fail, that you would lose everything, everything." Daylight stared his amazement at this cryptic utterance. "That sure beats me. I always said I got out of my depth with women, and you've got me out of my depth now. Why you want me to lose everything, seeing as you like me?"
"I never said so."
"You didn't dast say you didn't. So, as I was saying, liking me, why do you want me to go broke is clean beyond my simple understanding. It's right in line with that other puzzler of yours. The more you like me, the less you want to marry me, one. Well, you've just got to explain, that's all." His arms went around her, and he held her closely, and this time she did not resist. Her head was bowed, and he had not seen her face, yet he had a premonition that she was crying. He had learned the virtue of silence, and he waited her will in the matter. Things had come to such a pass that she was bound to tell him something now. Of that he was confident. "I am not romantic," she began, again looking at him as she spoke. "It might be better for me if I were. Then I could make a fool of myself and be unhappy for the rest of my life. But my abominable common sense prevents, and that doesn't make me a bit happier either. I'm still out of my depth and swimming feeble," Daylight said, after waiting vainly for her to go on. "You've got to show me, and you ain't shown me yet. Your common sense and praying that I'd go broke is all up in the air to me. Little woman, I just love you mighty hard, and I want you to marry me. That's straight and simple, and right off the bat. Will you marry me?" She shook her head slowly, and then, as she talked, seemed to grow angry, sadly angry, and Daylight knew that this anger was against him. "Then let me explain, and just as straight and simply as you have asked." She paused, as if casting about for a beginning. "You are honest and straightforward. Do you want me to be honest and straightforward, as a woman is not supposed to be? To tell you things that will hurt you, to make confessions that ought to shame me, to behave in what many men would think was an unwomanly manner." The arm around her shoulder pressed encouragement, but he did not speak. "I would dearly like to marry you, but I'm afraid. I am proud and humble at the same time that a man like you should care for me. But you have too much money. That's where my abominable common sense steps in. Even if we did marry, you could never be my man, my lover, and my husband. You would be your money's man. I know I'm a foolish woman, but I want a man for myself. You would not be free for me. Your money possesses you, taking your time, your thoughts, your energy, everything, bidding you go here, go there, do this, do that. Don't you see? Perhaps it's pure silliness, but I feel that I can love much, give all, and in return, though, I don't want all, I want much, and I want much more than your money would permit you to give me. And your money destroys you. It makes you less and less nice. I am not ashamed to say that I love you, because I shall never marry you. And I loved you much when I did not know you at all, when you first came down from Alaska and I first went into the office. You were my hero. You were the burning daylight of the gold diggings, the daring traveler and miner, and you looked it. I don't see how any woman could have looked at you without loving you then. But you don't look it now. Please, please, forgive me for hurting you. You wanted straight talk, and I'm giving it to you. All these last years you have been living unnaturally. You, a man of the open, have been cooping yourself up in the cities with all that that means. You are not the same man at all, and your money is destroying you. You are becoming something different, something not so healthy, not so clean, not so nice. Your money and your way of life are doing it. You know it. You haven't the same body now that you had then. You are putting on flesh, and it is not healthy flesh. You are kind and genial with me, I know, but you are not kind and genial to all the world as you were then. You have become harsh and cruel, and I know. Remember, I have studied you 6 days a week, month after month, year after year, and I know more about the most insignificant parts of you than you know of all of me. The cruelty is not only in your heart and thought, but it is there in your face. It has put its lines there. I have watched them come and grow. Your money and the life it compels you to lead have done all this. You are being brutalized and degraded, and this process can only go on and on until you are hopelessly destroyed. He attempted to interrupt, but she stopped him, herself breathless and her voice trembling. No, no, let me finish utterly. I have done nothing but think all these months, ever since you came riding with me, and now that I have begun to speak, I am going to speak all that I have in me. I do love you, but I cannot marry you and destroy love. You are growing into a thing that I must in the end despise. You can't help it. More than you can possibly love me, do you love this business game? This business, and it's all perfectly useless so far as you are concerned, claims all of you. I sometimes think it would be easier to share you equitably with another woman than to share you with this business. I might have half of you, at any rate, but this business would claim not half of you, but 9/10 of you, or 99/100. Remember, the meaning of marriage to me is not to get a man's money to spend. I want the man. You say you want me, and suppose I consented, but gave you only 1/100th part of me. Suppose there was something else in my life that took the other 99 parts, and furthermore, that ruined my figure, that put pouches under my eyes and crow's feet in the corners, that made me unbeautiful to look upon, and that made my spirit unbeautiful. Would you be satisfied with that 100th part of me? Yet that is all you are offering me of yourself. Do you wonder that I won't marry you, that I can't? Daylight waited to see if she were quite done, and she went on again. It isn't that I'm selfish. After all, love is giving, not receiving. But I see so clearly that all my giving could not do you any good. You are like a sick man. You don't play business like other men. You play at heart, and all of you. No matter what you believe and intend it, a wife would be only a brief diversion. There is that magnificent Bob eating his head off in the stable. You would buy me a beautiful mansion and leave me in it to yawn my head off, or cry my eyes out because of my helplessness and inability to save you. This disease of business would be corroding you and marring you all the time. You play it as you have played everything else. As in Alaska, you played the life of the trail. Nobody could be permitted to travel as fast and far as you, to work as hard or to endure as much. You hold back nothing. You put all you've got into whatever you are doing.
Limit is the sky, he grunted, grim affirmation.
But if you would only play the lover-husband that way. Her voice faltered and stopped, and a blush showed in her wet cheeks as her eyes fell before his.
And now I won't say another word, she added. I've delivered a whole sermon.
She rested now, frankly and fairly, in the shelter of his arms, and both were oblivious to the gale that rushed past them in quicker and stronger blasts. The big downpour of rain had not yet come, but the mist-like squalls were more frequent. Daylight was openly perplexed, and he was still perplexed when he began to speak.
I'm stumped. I'm up a tree. I'm clean flabbergasted. Miss Mason, or Dee Dee, because I love to call you that name. I'm free to confess there's a mighty big heap in what you say.
As I understand it, your conclusion is that you'd marry me if I hadn't a cent and I wasn't getting fat.
No, no, I'm not joking. I acknowledge the corn, and that's just my way of boiling the matter down and summing it up.
If I hadn't a cent, and if I was living a healthy life, with all the time in the world to love you and be your husband, instead of being awash to my back teeth in business and all the rest, why, you'd marry me.
That's all as clear as print, and you're correcter than I ever guessed before. You've sure opened my eyes a few. But I'm stuck. What can I do? My business has sure roped, thrown, and branded me. I'm tied hand and foot, and I can't get up and meander over green pastures. I'm like the man that got the bear by the tail. I can't let go, and I want you, and I've got to let go to get you.
I don't know what to do, but something's sure got to happen. I can't lose you. I just can't, and I'm not going to. Why, you're running business a close second right now. Business never kept me awake nights.
You've left me no argument. I know I'm not the same man that came from Alaska. I couldn't hit the trail with the dogs as I did in them days. I'm soft in my muscles, and my mind's gone hard. I used to respect men. I despise them now. You see, I've spent all my life in the open, and I reckon I'm an open-air man. Well, I've got the prettiest little ranch you ever laid eyes on, up in Glen Ellen. That's where I got stuck for that brickyard.
You recollect handling the correspondence? I only laid eyes on the ranch that one time, and I so fell in love with it that I bought it there and then. I just rode around the hills and was happy as a kid out of school. I'd be a better man living in the country. The city doesn't make me better. You're plumb right there. I know it. But suppose your prayer should be answered, and I'd go clean broke and have to work for day's wages.
She did not answer, though all the body of her seemed to urge consent.
Suppose I had nothing left but that little ranch and was satisfied to grow a few chickens and scratch a living somehow. Would you marry me then, Dee Dee?
Why, we'd be together all the time, she cried.
But I'd have to be out plowing once in a while, he warned, or driving to town to get the grub.
But there wouldn't be the office at any rate, and no man to see, and men to see without end.
But it's all foolish and impossible, and we'll have to be starting back now if we're to escape the rain.
Then was the moment among the trees where they began the descent of the hill that daylight might have drawn her closely to him and kissed her once. But he was too perplexed
with the new thoughts she had put into his head to take advantage of the situation. He merely caught her by the arm and helped her over the rougher footing. "It's darn pretty country up there at Glen Ellen," he said meditatively. "I wish you could see it." At the edge of the grove, he suggested that it might be better for them to part there. "It's your neighborhood, and folks is liable to talk." But she insisted that he accompany her as far as the house. "I can't ask you in," she said, extending her hand at the foot of the steps. The wind was humming wildly in sharply recurrent gusts, but still the rain held off. "Do you know," he said, "taking it by and large, it's the happiest day of my life." He took off his hat, and the wind rippled and twisted his black hair as he went on solemnly. "And I'm sure grateful to God, or whoever or whatever is responsible for you being on this earth, for you do like me heaps. It's been my joy to hear you say so today. It's..." He left the thought arrested, and his face assumed the familiar, whimsical expression as he murmured, "Dee Dee, Dee Dee, we've just got to get married. It's the only way, and trust the luck, for it's coming out all right." But the tears were threatening to rise in her eyes again, and she shook her head and turned and went up the steps. End of part 2, chapter 19. Part 2, chapter 20 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. When the ferry system began to run, and the times between Oakland and San Francisco was demonstrated to be cut in half, the tide of Daylight's terrific expenditure started to turn. Not that it really did turn, for he promptly went into further investments. Thousands of lots in his residential tracts were sold, and thousands of homes were being built. Factory sites also were selling, and business properties in the heart of Oakland. All this tended to a steady appreciation in value of Daylight's huge holdings. But as of old, he had his hunch, and he was riding it. Already he had begun borrowing from the banks. The magnificent profits he made on the land he sold were turning into more land, into more development, and instead of paying off old loans, he contracted new ones. As he had pyramided in Dawson City, he was now pyramided in Oakland. But he did it with the knowledge that it was a stable enterprise rather than a risky placer mining boom. In a small way, other men were following his lead, buying and selling land and profiting by the improvement work he was doing. But this was to be expected, and the small fortunes they were making at his expense did not irritate him. There was an exception, however, one Simon Dolliver, with money to go in with, and with cunning and courage to back it up, bade fair to become a several times millionaire at Daylight's expense. Dolliver, too, pyramided, playing quickly and accurately, and keeping his money turning over and over. More than once Daylight found him in the way, as he himself had gotten in the way of the Guggenhammers when they first set their eyes on Ophir Creek. Work on Daylight's dock system went on apace, yet was one of those enterprises that consumed money dreadfully, and that could not be accomplished as quickly as a ferry system. The engineering difficulties were great, the dredging and filling a cyclopean task. The mere item of pilings was anything but small. A good average pile, by the time it was delivered on the ground, cost a $20 gold piece, and these piles were used in unending thousands. All accessible groves of mature eucalyptus were used, and as well, great rafts of pine piles were towed down the coast from Puget Sound. Not content with manufacturing the electricity for street railways in the old-fashioned way, in powerhouses, Daylight organized the Sierra and Salvador Power Company. This immediately assumed large proportions. Crossing the San Joaquin Valley on the way from the mountains and plunging through the Contra Costa Hills, there were many towns and even a robust city that could be supplied with power, also with light, and it became a street and house lighting project as well. As soon as the purchase of power sites in the Sierra was rushed through, the survey parties were out and building operations begun. And so it went. There were a thousand maws into which he poured unceasing streams of money. But it was all so sound and legitimate that Daylight, born gambler that he was, and with his clear, wide vision, could not play softly and safely. It was a big opportunity, and to him there was only one way to play it, and that was the big way. Nor did his one confidential adviser, Larry Hagan, aid him to caution. On the contrary, it was Daylight who was compelled to veto the wilder visions of that able hashish dreamer. Not only did Daylight borrow heavily from the banks and trust companies, but on several of his corporations he was compelled to issue stock. He did this grudgingly, however, and retained most of his big enterprises of his own. Among the companies in which he reluctantly allowed the investing public to join were the Golden Gate Dock Company, the Recreation Parks Company, the United Water Company, and the Uniseal Shipbuilding Company, and the Sierra and Salvador Power Company. Nevertheless, between himself and Hagen, he retained the controlling share in each of these enterprises. His affair with Dede Mason only seemed to languish. While delaying to grapple with the strange problem it presented, his desire for her continued to grow. In his gambling simile, his conclusion was that luck had dealt him the most remarkable card in the deck, and that for years he had overlooked it. Love was the card, and it beat them all. Love was the king card of trumps, the fifth ace, the joker in a game of tenderfoot poker. It was the card of cards, and play it he would to the limit, when the opening came. He could not see that opening yet. The present game would have to play to some sort of conclusion first. Yet he could not shake from his brain and vision the warm recollection of those bronze slippers, that clinging gown, and all the feminine softness and pliancy of Dede in her pretty Berkeley rooms. Once again on a rainy Sunday, he telephoned that he was coming. And as has happened ever since man first looked upon woman and called her good, again he played the blind force of male compulsion against a woman's secret weakness to yield. Not that it was Daylight's way abjectly to beg and entreat. On the contrary, he was masterful in whatever he did, but he had a trick of whimsical wielding that Dede found harder to resist than the pleas of a suppliant lover. It was not a happy scene in its outcome, for Dede, in the throes of her own desire, desperate with weakness, and at the same time with her better judgment, hating her weakness, cried out, "You urge me to try a chance to marry you now, and trust to luck for it to come out right. And life is a gamble, say. Very well, let us gamble. Take a coin and toss it in the air. If it comes head, I'll marry you. If it doesn't, you are forever to leave me alone and never mention marriage again." A fire of mingled love and the passion of gambling came into Daylight's eyes. Involuntarily, his hand started for his pocket for the coin. Then it stopped, and the light in his eyes was troubled. "Go," she ordered sharply. "Don't delay, or I may change my mind, and you will lose the chance." "Little woman." His similes were humorous, but there was no humor in their meaning. His thought was as solemn as his voice. "Little woman, I'd gamble all the way from creation to the day of judgment. I'd gamble a golden harp against another man's halo. I'd toss for pennies on the front steps of the New Jerusalem, or set up a faro layout just outside the pearly gates. But I'll be everlastingly damned if I'll gamble on love. Love's too big to me to take a chance on. Love's got to be a sure thing. And between you and me, it is a sure thing. If the odds were 100 to 1 on my winning this flip, just the same, nary a flip. In the spring of that year, the great panic came on. The first warnings was when the banks began calling in their unprotected loans. Daylight promptly paid the first several of his personal notes that were presented. Then he divined that these demands but indicated the way the wind was going to blow, and that one of those terrific financial storms he had heard about was soon to sweep over the United States. How terrific this particular storm was to be, he did not anticipate. Nevertheless, he took every precaution in his power, and had no anxiety about his weathering it out. Money grew tighter, beginning with the crash of several of the greatest Eastern banking houses. The tightness spread until every bank in the country was calling in its credits. Daylight was caught, and caught because of the fact that for the first time he had been playing the legitimate business game. In the old days, such a panic, with the accompanying extreme shrinkage of values, would have been a golden harvest time for him. As it was, he watched the gamblers, who had ridden the wave of prosperity and made preparations for the slump, getting out from under and safely scurrying to cover or proceeding to reap a double harvest. Nothing remained for him but to stand fast and hold up. He saw the situation clearly. When the banks demanded that he pay his loans, he knew that the banks were in sore need of the money, but he was in sorer need, and he knew that the banks did not want his collateral which they held. It would do them no good. In such a tumbling of values was no time to sell. His collateral was good, all of it, eminently sound and worthwhile. Yet it was worthless at such a moment, when the one unceasing cry was money, money, money. Finding him obdurate, the banks demanded more collateral, and as the money pinch tightened, they asked for 2 and even 3 times as much as had been originally accepted. Sometimes Daylight yielded to these demands, but more often not, and always battling fiercely. He fought as with clay behind a crumbling wall. All portions of the wall were menaced, and he went around constantly strengthening the weakest parts with clay. This clay was money, and was applied, a sop here and a sop there, as fast as it was needed, but only when it was directly needed. The strength of his position lay in the Yerba Buena Ferry Company, the Consolidated Street Railways, and the United Water Company. Though people were no longer buying resident lots and factory and business sites, they were compelled to ride on his cars and ferry boats and to consume his water. When all the financial world was clamoring for money and perishing through lack of it, the first of each month many thousands of dollars poured into his coffers from the water rates, and each day $10,000 in dimes and nickels came in from his street railways and ferries. Cash was what was wanted, and had he had the use of all this steady river of cash, all would have been well with him. As it was, he had to fight continually for a portion of it. Improvement work ceased, and only absolutely essential repairs were made. His fiercest fight was with the operating expenses, and this was a fight that never ended. There was never any let-up in his turning the thumbscrews of extended credit and economy. From the big wholesale suppliers, down through the salary list, to office stationery and postage stamps, he kept the thumbscrews turning. When his superintendents and heads of departments performed prodigies of cutting down, he patted them on the back and demanded more. When they threw down their hands in despair, he showed them how more could be accomplished. "You are getting $8,000 a year," he told Matheson. "It's better pay than you ever got in your life before. Your fortune is in the same sack with mine. You've got to stand for some of the strain and risk. You've got a personal credit in this town. Use it. Stand off butcher and baker and all the rest, savvy? You're drawing down something like $660 a month. I want that cash. From now on, stand everybody off and draw down $100. I'll pay you interest on the rest till this blows over. 2 weeks later, with the payroll before them, it was, Matheson, who's this bookkeeper, Rogers, your nephew? I thought so. He's pulling down $85 a month. After this, let him draw $35. That $40 can ride with me at interest. Impossible, Matheson cried. He can't make ends meet on his salary as it is, and he has a wife and 2 kids. Daylight was upon him with a mighty oath. Can't? Impossible? What in hell do you think I'm running? A home for feeble-minded? Feeding and dressing and wiping the little noses of a lot of idiots that can't take care of themselves? Not on your life. I'm hustling, and now's the time that everybody that works for me has got to hustle. I want no fair-weather birds holding down my office chairs or anything else. This is nasty weather, damn nasty weather, and they've got to buck into it, just like me. There are 10,000 men out of work in Oakland right now, and 60,000 more in San Francisco. Your nephew and everybody else on your payroll can do as I say right now or quit. Savvy? If any of them get stuck, you go around yourself and guarantee their credit with the butchers and grocers, and you trim down that payroll accordingly. I've been carrying a few thousand folks that'll have to carry themselves for a while now. That's all. You say this filter's got to be replaced? He told his chief of waterworks. We'll see about it. Let the people of Oakland drink mud for a change. It'll teach them to appreciate good water. Stop work at once. Get those men off the payroll. Cancel all orders for material. The contractors will sue. Let them sue and be damned. We'll be busted hiring a kite or on Easy Street before they can get judgment. And to Wilkinson, take off that owl boat. Let the public roar and come home early to its wife. And there's that last car that connects with the 12:45 boat at 22nd and Hastings. Cut it out. I can't run it for 2 or 3 passengers. Let them take an earlier boat home or walk. This is no time for philanthropy, and you might as well take off a few more cars in the rush hours. Let the strap hangers pay. It's the strap hangers that'll keep us from going under. And to another chief, who broke down under the excessive strain of retrenchment. You say I can't do that and can't do this. I'll just show you a few of the latest patterns in the can and can't line. You'll be compelled to resign, all right. If you think so, I never saw a man that yet I was hard up for. And when any man thinks I can't get along without him, I just show him the latest pattern in that line of goods and give him his walking papers. And so he fought and drove and bullied, and even wheedled his way along. It was fight, 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 and no let-up, from the first thing in the morning till nightfall. His private office saw throngs every day. All men came to see him, or were ordered to come. Now it was an optimistic opinion on the panic, a funny story, a serious business talk, or a straight, take-it-or-leave-it blow from the shoulder. And there was nobody to relieve him. It was a case of drive, 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 and he alone could do the driving. And this went on day after day, while the whole business world rocked around him, and house after house crashed to the ground. "It's all right, old man," he told Hagen every morning, and it was the same cheerful word that he passed out all day long, except at such times when he was in the thick of fighting to have his will with persons and things. 8 o'clock saw him at his desk each morning. By 10 o'clock it was into the machine and away for a round of the banks, and usually in the machine with him was the $10,000 and more that had been earned by his ferries and railways the day before. This was for the weakest spot in the financial dike, and with one bank president after another, similar scenes were enacted. They were paralyzed with fear, and first of all, he played his role of the big, vital optimist. Times were improving. Of course they were. The signs were already in the air. All that anybody had to do was to sit tight a little longer and hold on. That was all. Money was already more active in the East. Look at the trading on Wall Street of the last 24 hours. That was a straw that showed the wind. Hadn't Ryan said so and so? And wasn't it reported that Morgan was preparing to do this and that? As for himself, weren't the street railway earnings increasing steadily? In spite of the panic, more and more people were coming to Oakland right along. Movements were already beginning in the real estate. He was dickering, even then, to sell over 1,000 of the suburban acres. Of course, it was at a sacrifice, but it would ease the strain on all of them and bolster up the faint-hearted. That was the trouble, the faint-hearts. Had there been no faint-hearts, there would have been no panic. There was that Eastern Syndicate negotiating with him now to take the majority of the stock in the Sierra and Salvador Power Company off his hands. That showed confidence that better times were at hand. And if it was not cheery discourse, but prayer and entreaty, or showdown and fight on the part of the banks, daylight had to counter in kind. If they could bully, he could bully. If the favor he asked were refused, it became the thing he demanded. And when it came down to raw and naked fighting, with the last veil of sentiment or illusion torn off, he could take their breaths away. But he knew, also, how and when to give in. When he saw the wall shaking and crumbling irretrievably at a particular place, he patched it up with sops of cash from his three cash-earning companies. If the banks went, he went too. It was a case of their having to hold out. If they smashed, and all the collateral they held of his was thrown on the chaotic market, it would be the end. And so it was, as the time passed, that on occasion his red motor car carried, in addition to the daily cash, the most gilt-edged securities he possessed, namely, the Ferry Company, United Water and Consolidated Railways. But he did this reluctantly, fighting inch by inch. As he told the president of the Merchants San Antonio, who made the plea of carrying so many others, "They're small fry. Let them smash. I'm the kingpin here. You've got more money to make out of me than them. Of course, you're carrying too much, and you've got to choose, that's all. It's root hog or die for you or them. I'm too strong to smash. You could only embarrass me and get yourself tangled up. Your way out is to let the small fry go, and I'll lend you a hand to do it." And it was daylight also, in this time of financial anarchy, who sized up Simon Dolliver's affairs and lent the hand that sent that rival down in utter failure. The Golden Gate National was the keystone of Dolliver's strength, and to the president of that institution daylight said, "Here I've been lending you a hand, and you now in the last ditch, with Dolliver riding on you and me all the time. It don't go, you hear me? It don't go. Dolliver couldn't cough up $11 to save you. Let him get off and walk, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the railway nickels for 4 days. That's 40,000 cash. And on the 6th of the month, you can count on 20,000 more from the water company." He shrugged his shoulders. "Take it or leave it. Them's my terms. It's dog-eat-dog, and I ain't overlooking any meat that's floating around," daylight proclaimed that afternoon to Hagen. And Simon Dolliver went the way of the unfortunate in the great panic who were caught with plenty of paper but no money. Daylight's shifts and devices were amazing. Nothing, however large or small, passed his keen sight unobserved. The strain he was under was terrific. He no longer ate lunch. The days were too short, and his noon hours and his office were as crowded as at any other time. By the end of the day he was exhausted, and, as never before, he sought relief behind his wall of alcoholic inhibition. Straight to his hotel he was driven, and straight to his rooms he went, where immediately was mixed for him the first of a series of double martinis. By dinner, his brain was well clouded and the panic forgotten. By bedtime, with the assistance of Scotch whiskey, he was full, not violently or uproariously full, nor stupefied, but merely well under the influence of a pleasant and mild anesthetic. Next morning he awoke with parched lips and mouth, and with sensations of heaviness in his head, which quickly passed away. By 8 o'clock he was at his desk, buckled down to the fight. By 10 o'clock, on his personal rounds of the bank, and after that, without a moment's cessation till nightfall, he was handling the knotty tangles of industry, finance, and human nature that crowded upon him. And with nightfall, it was back to the hotel, the double martinis, and the scotch. And this was his program, day after day, until the days ran into weeks. End of Part 2, Chapter 20. Part 2, Chapter 21 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Though daylight appeared among his fellows, hearty-voiced, inexhaustible, spilling over with energy and vitality, deep down he was a very weary man. And sometime under the liquor drug, snatches of wisdom came to him with far more lucidity than in his sober moments, as, for instance, one night, when he sat on the edge of the bed with one shoe in his hand and meditated on Didi's aphorism to the effect that he could not sleep in more than one bed at a time. Still holding the shoe, he looked at the array of horsehair bridles on the walls. Then, carrying the shoe, he got up and solemnly counted them, journeying into the two adjoining rooms to complete the tale. Then he came back to the bed and gravely addressed his shoe. The little woman's right, only one bed at a time. 140 hair bridles and nothing doing with area one of them. One bridle at a time. I can't ride one horse at a time. Poor old Bob, I'd better be sending you out to pasture. $30 million and $100 million or nothing in sight. And what have I got to show for it? There's lots of things money can't buy. It can't buy the little woman. It can't buy capacity. What's the good of 30 millions when I ain't got room for more than a quart of cocktails a day? If I had 100-quart cocktail thirst, it'd be different. But one quart, one measly little quart, here I am, a 30 times over millionaire, slaving harder every day than a dozen men that work for me, and all I get is two meals that don't taste good, one bed, a quart of martini, and 140 hair bridles to look at on the wall. He stared around at the array disconsolately. Mr. Shoe, I'm sizzled. Good night. Far worse than the controlled, steady drinker is the solitary drinker, and it was this that daylight was developing into. He rarely drank sociably any more, but in his own room by himself. Returning weary from each day's unremitting effort, he drugged himself to sleep, knowing that on the morrow he would rise up with a dry and burning mouth and repeat the program. But the country did not recover with its wonted elasticity. Money did not become freer, though the casual reader of daylight's newspapers, as well as all the other owned and subsidized newspapers in the country, could have only concluded that the money tightness was over and that the panic was a past history. All public utterances were cheery and optimistic, but privately, many of the utterers were in desperate straits. The scenes enacted in the privacy of Daylight's office and of the meetings of his boards of directors would have given the lie to the editorials in his newspaper, as, for instance, when he addressed the big stockholders in the Sierra and Salvador Power Company, the United Water Company, and the several other stock companies. "You've got to dig. You've got a good thing, but you'll have to sacrifice in order to hold on. There ain't no use spouting hard times explanations." "Don't I know the hard times is on? Ain't that what you're here for? As I said before, you've got to dig. I run the majority stock, and it's come to a case of assets. It's that or smash. If I ever start going, you won't know what struck you. I'll smash that hard. The small fry can let go, but you big ones can't. The ship won't sink as long as you stay with her. But if you start to leave her, down you'll sure go before you can get to shore. This assessment has got to be met, that's all." The big wholesale supply houses, the caterers for his hotels, and all the crowd that incessantly demanded to be paid, had their hot half-hours with him. He summoned them to his office and displayed his latest patterns of can and can't and will and won't. "By God, you've got to carry me," he told them. "If you think this is a pleasant little game of parlor whist, and that you can quit and go home whenever you want, you're plumb wrong. Look here, Watkins, you remarked 5 minutes ago that you wouldn't stand for it. Now let me tell you a few. You're going to stand for it and keep on standing for it. You're going to continue supplying me and taking my paper until the pinch is over. How you're going to do it is your trouble, not mine. You remember what I did to Klinkner and the Altamont Trust Company. I know the inside of your business better than you do yourself. And if you try to drop me, I'll smash you. Even if I'd be going to smash myself, I'd find a minute to turn on you and bring you down with me. It's sink or swim for all of us, and I reckon you'll find it to your interest to keep me on top the puddle." Perhaps his bitterest fight was with the stockholders of the United Water Company, for it was practically the whole of the gross earnings of this company that he voted to lend to himself and used to bolster up his wide battlefront. Yet he never pushed his arbitrary rule too far, compelling sacrifice from the men whose fortunes were tied up with his. Nevertheless, when any one of them was driven to the wall and was in dire need, Daylight was there to help him back into line. Only a strong man could have saved so complicated a situation in such a time of stress, and Daylight was that man. He turned and twisted, schemed and devised, bludgeoned and bullied the weaker ones, kept the faint-hearted in the fight, and had no mercy on the deserter. And in the end, when early summer was on, everything began to mend. Came a day when Daylight did the unprecedented. He left the office an hour earlier than usual, and for the reason that for the first time since the panic there was not an item of work waiting to be done. He dropped into Hagen's private office before leaving for a chat, and as he stood up to go, he said, "Hagen, we're all hunkadory. We're pulling out of the financial pawn shop in fine shape, and we'll get out without leaving one unredeemed pledge behind. The worst is over, and the end is in sight. Just a tight rein for a couple more weeks, just a bit of a pinch or a flurry or so now and then, and we can let go and spit on our hands." For once he varied his program. Instead of going directly to his hotel, he started on a round of the bars and cafes, drinking a cocktail here and a cocktail there, and two or three when he encountered men he knew. It was after an hour or so of this that he dropped into the bar of the Parthenon for one last drink before going to dinner. By this time, All his being was pleasantly warmed by the alcohol, and he was in the most genial and best of spirits. At the corner of the bar, several young men were up to the old trick of resting their elbows and attempting to force each other's hands down. One broad-shouldered young giant never removed his elbow, but put down every hand that came against him. Daylight was interested. "It's Slosson," the barkeeper told him in an answer to his query. "He's the heavy hammer thrower at the UC. Broke all records this year, and the world's record on top of it. He's a husky, all right." Daylight nodded and went over to him, placing his own arm in opposition. "I'd like to go you a flutter, son, on that proposition," he said. The young man laughed and locked hands with him, and to Daylight's astonishment, it was his own hand that was forced down on the bar. "Hold on," he muttered. "Just one more flutter. I reckon I wasn't just ready that time." Again the hands locked. It happened quickly. The offensive attack of Daylight's muscles slipped instantly into defense, and resisting vainly, his hand was forced over and down. Daylight was dazed. It had been no trick. The skill was equal, or, if anything, the superior skill had been his. Strength, sheer strength, had done it. He called for the drinks, and still dazed and pondering, held up his own arm and looked at it as at some new strange thing. He did not know this arm. It certainly was not the arm he had carried around with him all the years. The old arm? Why, it would have been play to turn down that young husky's. But this arm? He continued to look at it with such dubious perplexity as to bring a roar of laughter from the young men. This laughter aroused him. He joined in at first, and then his face slowly grew grave. He leaned toward the hammer-thrower. "Son," he said, "let me whisper a secret. Get out of here and quit drinking before you begin." The young fellow flushed angrily, but Daylight held steadily on. "You listen to your dad and let him say a few. I'm a young man myself, only I ain't. Let me tell you, several years ago, for me to turn your hand down would have been like committing assault and battery on a kindergarten." Slosson looked his incredulity, while the others grinned and clustered around Daylight encouragingly. "Son, I ain't given to preaching. This is the first time I ever come to the penitent form, and you put me there yourself, hard. I've seen a few in my time, and I ain't fastidious, so as you can notice it. But let me tell you right that I'm worth the devil alone knows how many millions, and that I'd sure give it all right here on the bar to turn down your hand. Which means I'd give the whole shooting match just to be back where I was before I quit sleeping under the stars and come into the hen-coops of cities to drink cocktails and lift up my feet and ride. Son, that's the matter with me, and that's the way I feel about it. The game ain't worth the candle. You just take care of yourself and roll my advice over once in a while. Good night." He turned and lurched out of the place, the moral effect of his utterance largely spoiled by the fact that he was so patently full while he uttered it. Still in a daze, Daylight made to his hotel, accomplished his dinner, and prepared for bed. "The damned young whippersnapper," he muttered. "Put my hand down, easy as you please. My hand." He held up the offending member and regarded it with stupid wonder. The hand that had never been beaten, the hand that had made the Circle City giants wince. And a kid from college, with a laugh on his face, had put it down twice. Dede was right. He was not the same man. The situation would bear more serious looking into than he had ever given it. But this was not the time. In the morning, after a good sleep, he would give it consideration. End of Part 2, Chapter 21.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.